Hello, everyone. I'm going to invite Sam up. Do you come and grab a seat if you haven't got one already? Sam, thanks so much for coming.
You're welcome.
We're really pleased that you're here. Just tell us, we heard your kind of Oxford stats, as it were, earlier in terms of post-rock.
Apparently, they got my college wrong.
Yeah, sorry, I said Lincoln. I meant New College. It's New College, not Lincoln College. Sorry, both to Lincoln and to New College. Sam, tell us about your family and maybe just a little bit on kind of how you came to follow the Lord Jesus for yourself.
Sure. So I'm Sam. I'm married to Julie, who's German, hence the Y. We have three kids. John, who's actually about there now, who's in year 8. Sophia, who's in year 6, and Claire, who's in year 3. School's up just out of town. How did I come to follow the Lord? It's sort of a strange thing. So I grew up in a Christian family. My grandfather was a vicar, but as my name suggests, not all my family has always been Christian. I have pretty much the most Jewish name you can possibly come up with, Samuel Cohen. But my family, my immediate family, are Christians. The church I grew up in mainly was quite high church. So it was a high church Anglican. I carried a candle. And it was a good place to grow up, but it was a good place in many ways, but it wasn't a good place for a teenager to grow up. And so I would say, while I've always known who Jesus is, while I've always known that I trust him as my Lord, it was when I was at university that I actually figured out what that meant. So I went to university in Adelaide, which is Australia, went to a church quite similar to this in Adelaide. It's the oldest church in the city at 1836. So, yeah, slightly different to here in that way. But big student church and similar thing to Webb's.
Super. Sam, thank you. I'm going to hand straight over to you. Over to you.
Okay. Well, thank you for listening to my random ramblings. It's very strange to be asked to do this because I'm a mathematician, and then they say, "Oh, come and talk about something about being a mathematician," and you go, "Okay, what's that going to mean?" So I thought what I'd try and say a few brief thoughts on, hopefully brief, is how does being a Christian make sense of maths? It's something that I've been thinking about for a while. How does it help me in my work? And while I understand most of you are not mathematicians, some of you, I hope, will see at least some similarities with what you're doing. So I thought I'd begin with the really most mathematical end, where saying, well, one of the things, being a Christian, knowing something about the world we live in, helps us to understand why maths works. So there's a very famous article published in 1960 by a guy called Eugene Wigner, a Jewish-Hungarian guy, but lived most of his life in the US. He won the Nobel in physics in 1963, so not a small fish. But he wrote an article in 1960 saying, well, the title really says it all. It was On the Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics in the Natural Sciences. And his postulate was that it's really weird how well maths works. And he had various examples where he said sort of, well, gravity, we had really bad observations of gravity, but managed to guess what the rules should be, and they're actually really, really accurate, if you go back to the original guesses. Or we have people like James Clerk Maxwell, who was sitting there trying to understand how magnets work. He did some calculations, and there was this strange constant that kept appearing, and he thought about what it was and realized it was quite similar to the speed of light, which they sort of knew at the time. And so he basically guessed that this meant that light and magnetism are the same thing. And he was right. And so James Clerk Maxwell, Maxwell's equations, if you're a physicist, if you're an engineer, if you're a mathematician, you've probably seen them. They describe all of electromagnetic theory, and they basically are the stepping stone to go from Newton and how do you understand falling things and stars going round and round through to Einstein and how do you understand the effects of gravitational fields. There's a step in the middle, which is magnetic fields, and that's James Clerk Maxwell. So Wigner's question was, why is it that maths works so well? And to my mind, that's one of the biggest challenges to a naturalistic philosophy of science. Because the world seems just too regular. Now, if you go for a very Platonist view, you say the world is made up of ideas, then you run into a whole lot of problems because you've got to put the ideas somewhere and you've got to have something thinking the ideas. On the other hand, as a Christian, we can address this and we can say, actually, we understand why the world is ordered. We don't need to go full on Platonism. We can just say the world is ordered. Why? Because it was made to be ordered. And the fact that we somehow have minds that are able to interact with that order, get something out of it, is not so surprising if we know who we are. And so we can see mathematics. We can see why it is that I can take the equations that we use to describe heat flow in a rod, and I take exactly the same equations and I use them to describe risk measurements in finance. And we can sort of see that it's not quite so strange that those two things should end up being the same. Because the world is ordered. There is structures there that we are discovering, real things. And this leads to, for myself, a lot of fun. People often see mathematicians as rather boring people, and I'm afraid to say that the stereotype is not entirely invalid. But at least we have a lot of fun ourselves. And there is something really quite exciting when you sit down and you start trying to figure something out and it works. I sometimes like these sort of Rube Goldberg machine videos, even though half of them are fake, where you sort of have a marble dropping down and everything just fits together and it all works. And that is what doing maths is often like. You start with something and you say, well, listen, I don't know if this is going to work. And then the pieces fall together and you go, this is fantastic. It's great fun. And being a Christian means that I can just say, well, yes, of course it should be fun. Doesn't surprise me. It's great. Okay, that was the first thought. The second thought, why on earth do I do what I do? So people sometimes say, are you a pure mathematician or an applied mathematician? I have to say no. I don't do simply abstract stuff, but neither do I do useful stuff. I'll come back to that point. I do things in the middle. So my work is, I'm a probability theorist, so I think a lot about random things. I think about how do you make decisions with randomness. And what I do is I take real problems, abstract them so far that they're not really useful anymore, but at least I can get a handle on how they work, and try and figure them out. And in this, by taking it so abstract that I end up really pulling on a lot of the very abstract mathematics that people have worked out and developing that as well. So I'm sort of sitting somewhere in the middle. But it does raise the question, why do I do what I do? What is the point? Well, on one hand, it pays the bills, and that's great, and I can be in Oxford, and Oxford's quite a pretty place to be, and it's nice, which is fine. But is that a sensible and reasonable use of my time? Because I don't have unlimited time, I don't have unlimited energy, so why am I spending it doing this? And I think there's a few things that we can say. For all I say that what I do is not useful, history has shown us that doing mathematics is useful. That the mathematicians sit in their room and they do all these fun things, and eventually an engineer comes along and says, oh, that looks interesting, and it turns out to be useful. And what that means is that we go along and we do these things not knowing where they're going to be used, not knowing how they're going to be useful, but still thinking they're quite valuable to do. Now, as a Christian, how do I understand this? We know that we are made in the world. We know that we are made to look after it. And we have a duty to be wise in how we use the resources we have. But we also know that we're not abandoned. And so we can take risks. And we can do these things. So I can do mathematics. I can have fun and not know where it's going to go and know that it's going to actually work out. Strangely. Because God has not abandoned us. Now, why do I do it? It's also, as I say, it's fun. Usually. Tomorrow night when I'm marking tutorial sheets, don't ask me whether it's fun. And it's work, it's good work, and some of it is interesting, some of it isn't. But that is, it is what work is like. It is, on the one hand, great and good and fun and rewarding and creative and enjoyable, and on the other hand, it's work. It's toil, it's labor, it's painful. And as a Christian, part of what we can see in creation is that those two things don't have to sit in pure opposition to each other. We can see that we've made in a good world, a perfect world, a fantastic world, and we can see that it's broken, and we can see that work is toil, and those things we can hold simultaneously to be true without feeling that we're in some sort of binary opposition. So this is why do I do what I do? Well, it's in some sense who I am. I enjoy it. I think I'm reasonably good at it. Other people seem to think I'm reasonably good at it. It's not that I'm called to do it. It's not that this is the only thing I could ever do, but it is a good thing to do, and so I'm happy to do it. Finally, I thought I'd say a few things about some challenges in being a mathematician or generally an academic. So I don't know if you've noticed, but the academic world really looks for success. There's a huge cult of success in academia. Your worth is determined largely by what you've published, what you've done, and particularly what you've done recently. It's whether you've got grants, whether you've got students who've gone on to great things, whether you've solved big problems, whether you've been invited to nice places to give talks. And this leads to a variety of challenges, which I'm sure many of you will sort of feel some sympathy with. On the one hand, there's the question of self-promotion, that a lot of what I do, I have to actually go out and say that I'm fantastic. I have to go out and I can sit and I can do work that I think is good, but then I do have to go out and tell people about it and tell people, actually, this is the right way to do something. I have to stand up there and say, I'm actually good at this, I know this, and I'm promoting my own work. And that is a hard thing to do. It's particularly hard not to believe your own propaganda. It's hard to stand up and say, I've done something good, without that actually feeding into me thinking this is what makes me a good person. Especially when you're in an environment where that's what everyone else is looking at. On the other hand, you have the phenomenon, which I'm sure many of you heard of imposter syndrome, where people feel that they're mediocre and unworthy. Now, there's a guy who you probably haven't heard of called Terry Tao. So he's a mathematician at UCLA. He's a very interesting guy. I've met him a couple of times, but I know his brother reasonably well because he's actually from the same place in Australia that I am. So I met his brother, who was at university at the same time as me. Terry Tao is arguably the greatest mathematician alive. He's got a pretty good claim to it. He has changed significant areas of mathematics, at least three distinct areas of mathematics he's the leader in. Okay? So he won the Fields Medal a few years ago, which is the sort of big prize in mathematics under 40. He's an impressive individual. But he wrote a couple of weeks ago an article for the Princeton Alumni magazine. It was sort of a puff piece, look at our alumni, how wonderful they are, because he did his doctorate there. But I thought I'd read you a couple of paragraphs from it, which I thought were very interesting. So whatever his own gifts may be, Tao rejects the notion that mathematics is reserved for geniuses. Yes, he has heard people call him the Mozart of math. It's a moniker he dislikes. He has seen the 1984 movie Amadeus. Mozart is portrayed as a complete buffoon and really annoying, and I don't want to be like that, Tao explains. Also, he dies very young. Sly humor aside, Tao's reasons go deeper. Remarkably, the character who moves him is not Mozart, but his rival, Antonio Salieri. Someone described Amadeus, this is Tao commenting, someone described Amadeus as one of the best depictions of mediocrity, of what it's like to have enough talent to recognize genius, but not enough to be one, Tao says. All academics feel for the Salieri character. Now, it's rather weird to hear Terry Tao saying this, because he has achieved pretty much every award possible in mathematics. In his area, he is, by any scale, a genius, whatever this means. And yet he himself looks at the watches that film, and he sees and associates with the guy who's not a genius, but who looks at someone else and says, well, there's genius, but it isn't me. How do we feel about this? Because I'm sure a lot of you feel the same way. You know people that are better than you, and you look at them and say, well, they're great, but I'm not. Well, as a Christian, at least I'm not surprised. We can actually hold these tensions of the pride and the self-promotion and believing what you're saying and saying, I'm actually doing something great. That can be held at the same time as saying, well, I'm not a genius. I look over there and there's someone who is, but it isn't me. And actually knowing they're probably doing the same thing, whether looking this way or somewhere else, I don't know, but they're probably feeling the same way. We're unsurprised. We know that we're great. The pinnacle of God's creation, perfect, a good thing, made as the image of God. And we know we're broken and woeful and really not that great. And those two things are not a surprise that we hold them in tension. And when I see this in this small area of life, okay, I'm not surprised at least. How does being a Christian help me, though? Well, it means that I can look beyond that, because that's not what gives us worth. We can read Ecclesiastes and see the line, sort of, is it better to be a fool or be wise? Well, they both die and their names are forgotten. Doesn't matter. But for us, we know that we will be remembered. We have a God who knows us, who knows our name, who's written it down and will remember us. We've got a better worth, we've got a better story, who we are and where we get value, much better than I'm the guy who proved that you can have very generic types of jumps in a backward stochastic differential equation and everything still remains fine. If that is where I put my worth and my value, I'm in trouble. We've got a better story than this. We've got a better place to find our worth. We've got better goals. But we shouldn't deceive ourselves. When we say we've got better goals, that means what we're trying to do is to be someone who is remembered as a good servant on the last day. And what does that mean for me? It means I'm not trying to be the best researcher or the best teacher. Those are good things. But they can't be my ultimate goal, because if they are, then I've gotten myself confused as to what I'm trying to do. And because they're not going to be my ultimate goal, I need to accept the fact that that is a price. I'm not going to be as good as I could be by the standards of the community I live in. I'm giving something up for something better, but it leads me to live in tension. But a much better tension than the ones that I would have if I still stayed there. My goals are to live well, to be a witness and a light, and to show who God is where I am, And that is certainly an achievable goal, at least in part, by God's help. Okay, well, I was told to say a few thoughts, so there's a few thoughts. I hope some of them have been interesting and or helpful. Happy to take questions, comments disguised as questions. You ever go to an academic conference, you usually get the, I have a question in five parts, four of which are, you've forgotten to mention this.
Why don't we, just because some people are internal processes and need a moment, why don't we take 30 seconds to chat to a neighbor if there are any thoughts, questions, or thoughts disguised as questions for Sam, and then we'll come back in 30 seconds. Okay, hopefully that's enough time. Does anyone have any questions or comments for Sam? We always finish by two, by the way, so we won't go for much longer. Luke has got one. Great, let's go with Luca.
It's a good question. So the mic didn't sound like it was working. Did people hear the question? Okay, what happens if you're in an area and you think you can actually be the greatest and the Christians are consistently being outshone by non-Christians? Should you then commit to being really, really good in your area? I suppose I don't want to say that it's not good to try and do well. My point was that that's a secondary goal. So, of course, I try and be a good researcher. I try and write really good papers. I try and say interesting things. But it means that I'm going to do some things which would perhaps not be wise if I was purely just focused on an academic career. Now, let me see, what sort of examples are there of this? There are plenty of stories of people who supervise students, research students, I'm thinking, and if they're good, they'll look after them, and if they're not, they're basically going to let them fall on the grounds that they don't have time to look after those people. That is not something I can do. That is not a sacrifice I can make. Yes, it's going to cost me time. And it is better for me to do that, and it's better for Christ for me to do that, because people notice these things, people see these things, and that is actually more valuable than writing one more paper. Now, there are Christians who have done amazing things. So Maxwell, for example, who I mentioned, yeah, he's a while ago, but he's such a great example. Because, as I say, he's sort of top three physicists of all time. And if you read his writings, he's very clearly a serious Christian. There's no ambiguity in him. He writes poetry. And you read the poetry and you go, yeah, okay. He set up the physics laboratories in Cambridge, the Cavendish laboratories, and he had the Psalms inscribed over the doorway of greater the works of the Lord, blessed are those who look at them. He had this inscribed over the physics laboratory in Cambridge when he set it up. So there's no ambiguity there, and he was a great researcher. But for Christ, what's more important is that he was a good man. That's what people are going to notice, and that's what's going to point people to Christ more than the fact that he did great physics. And so I think, while I see your point, and certainly I've my own temperament, there's some ambition there. I've tried to do really well, but it's got to not be the ultimate goal. Otherwise, I'll fail at both, ultimately.
Thanks, Sam. Luca, great question. Any other thoughts or questions? David Fels, who is a physicist, but I suspect not a poet.
Please surprise him now.
No, I was trying to think of a haiku, but the question is too long. It seems to me, sorry, this maybe question might seem a bit impertinent,
Go for it.
But it seems to me that doing the sorts of things you're doing, you could quite easily change jobs, go into the city, make loads of money, and then give it to a church. So why have you chosen to be in academia rather than do that?
Yep. So I train a lot of quants. I'm in the mathematical finance group, and I teach these people. I also, in one of my other hats, I run the machine learning and finance program at the Alan Turing Institute. So, yep, I could jump ship and go to industry. There would be nothing morally wrong with doing that. There would be a danger. I know myself, and I know that I don't necessarily think I would be the best person to be given a lot of money to. So at a simple level of, I just don't know whether that would be good for me to have that sort of responsibility. And I think that's the way we have to think about these sorts of money. If we're talking about going for a job largely for the purposes of getting money with all the best intentions in the world, you have to think, do you really think that you are the person who should be making this decision? And maybe the answer sometimes is, yes, that's appropriate. But often I think we need to be aware that that's a really, it's quite a scary thing to do. And the Bible's very clear that having a lot of money is not a good idea for you. So on one level, there wouldn't be anything wrong with it. I enjoy what I do. I enjoy the freedom that it gives me to think about the things that interest me. I enjoy the fact that I can be home and see my kids and my family. And to be perfectly honest, I often get asked this question during formal dinners in college, to which my response is, clearly I'm slumming it here. So I don't feel that I've gone to any great extent to lead a life of deprivation and poverty. But yeah, it's of course, the thought has crossed my mind many times. But I enjoy what I do. So I'll do that.
Thanks, Sam. That's really helpful. Any other questions or thoughts?
Okay. So kind of related to that, but particularly maybe for people who are looking at going, like, what they're going to do with their lives, whether they want to pursue further academics, how do you sort of balance the sometimes discouraging element of doing quite theoretical work with the fact that, yeah, as Christians, there's so many opportunities to be doing vocational things instead, and the sort of the impact of what you're doing, you know, might not be felt for years and years and years. Whereas there, you know, there are other options for doing the kind of work that has sort of an immediate impact. And how do you reconcile it? That sort of, yeah.
It's tricky. I don't think there's a simple balance between those things. This is where I think, so part of it is that we are part of a community and not every person has to be doing things which are immediately applied. So that's one element of the answer. And so this is where I can go and do my things expecting that they will be helpful even though I'm not seeing the immediate use of them. We also have the fact that ultimately, God is in control, and that gives us great confidence to go and do things not being immediately sure of how it's going to work out, because God is ultimately in control. And so you can, of course, play this out if you want to go take it to the ridiculous extreme. It's, well, should I go and be a sort of an evil banker trying to destroy corporations, or should I go and be a teacher? Well, okay, teacher's better than evil banker, sure. Should I be a teacher or should I be a nurse? Well, teachers are good, but nurses are really helping people when things are really tough. So nurse is better. Should I be a nurse or should I be an aid worker? And you end up going, well, should I be an aid worker or should I be purely a scripture-based missionary? And you end up eventually saying, well, there's very few things that you can say are ultimately good. And so this is where you have to actually step back a bit and say, well, I'm not in control. I need to look at what can I do that is valuable and good and will use my skills. God is in control and will look after this world. and I need to be wise. And I think that's, at least for me, the way it sort of panned out. But I admit that's not a perfect answer.
Sam, thanks so much. I wish we'd recorded that because there was gold nuggets everywhere. Thanks so much for coming. Do feel free to grab Sam after a 9:45 service. He's quite easy to spot and ask him more questions.
What are you getting at?
Nothing. And I'm just jealous. And you'll stick around for a bit now. Great. So do come and find him now if you'd like to. Enjoy the rest of your afternoon.